Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So this is the final episode of my Venice coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, and this is a part of the best of category. So this is a piece called Constant Apollyad. So this is a collective reading experience by Sister Sylvester and Nada Al-Sharsley. So this originally was a live performance, and then they created it as a automated performance in a way that they recorded the performance as well as the music. And they have this book that you're reading. And then as you're reading the book, they're also like telling the story of Cavafe, who is this poet who lived from 1893 to 1933. And so basically Onassis Foundation got a hold of the archive of this poet and then asked Sister Sylvester to create immersive performance out of that. So she created this performance and then decided to make a book out of it. And so with that book, it sort of contains a whole story about Cavafe, as well as his explorations of homosexuality in a time that was extremely taboo. And so there's different ways that the book itself is, I'm calling it a book, it's more of a book object that has more of a pop-up book nature, but also more of a spatial architectural dimension of it. And so it kind of unfolds in a way that you read it, but you're being read to. And so there's a way in which that Sister Sylvester is recording her voice, reading it to you, and you're kind of flipping through it. And you're also doing it with another person. So it ends up being this kind of collective reading experience with another person as you're learning about this 19th to 20th century poet named Cavafe. So the contextual domains that are being explored is that it's the exploration of identity as a person has moved from his home and into this distant and far off land with some feelings of being exiled, but also with the implications of being a homosexual within the context of having to remain hidden because of all the different taboo natures of that. So it's dipping into the vast archive of Cavafe's expressions of identity, as well as his poetry and art, and kind of recontextualizing it within the context of these universal experiences that we all can connect to. And that's very much relevant to today. And so I had a really quite interesting conversation with Sister Sylvester going through all the different elemental components. I think she is somebody who is resistant to this whole idea and concept of immersive. Even though she's being shown at Venice Immersive, she has much more of a Brechtian approach of trying to create this critical distance and alienation so that you watch a piece and you feel like you're motivated to actually bring collective agency and change within the world rather than having this emotional catharsis within the context of the piece. And so there's certain philosophical resistances that she has against this word of immersion, because immersion for her kind of implies this more Aristotelian catharsis of emotion rather than being critically engaged and active within the context of seeing a piece and being motivated to go out and bring change out in the world. And I totally get that, and the valid critique. At the same time, I feel like, you know, part of experiential and immersive field is that trying to come up with these conceptual frameworks for understanding what is actually happening with these different pieces that we're seeing. You know, this is a book that people are reading together, and there's music and there's other kind of immersive quality and components, but there's no virtual reality, augmented reality, anything. And so that this is a perfect piece to kind of end on, just because there are certain aspects of this piece that are exemplifying different aspects of what I would call broadly experiential design and this type of immersive storytelling, even if those words are not ones that Sister Sylvester decides to adopt within her own right. In the final episode here, I'm going to be airing a lecture that I gave on June 6th of 2026 at Seattle XR that is going into the blending of the elements. That is probably one of the most coherent distillations of the philosophical foundations that I'm trying to lay down for the elements. I'm leaning a lot upon Empedocles, the ancient classic philosophy, but also mashing that up into different elements of Alfred North Whitehead's process philosophy. And then more and more, I'm integrating aspects of Peircean semiotics and firstness, secondness, and thirdness. And that doesn't necessarily show up as much into that talk, but I hope as I move forward to kind of elaborate more of these qualities of presence, these different context, character, and story. And so as I've been introducing all of the different Venice Immersive episodes this year, I've been kind of walking through both the context, the elemental balance, as well as the themes and character dynamics, just to kind of help flesh out how this is being applied. So a little bit more longer introductions than I've done in the past, but hopefully helps to contextualize these experiences that probably most people will not have a chance to see. So to go through the different elemental balance, I think Sister Sylvester as a creator is very much biased towards the air element in terms of like wanting you to read and use your mind and the critical engagement and capacities of your mind as you're reading to think and critically reflect. So kind of deconstructing and also analyzing. And so that's kind of borne out through the different types of experiences that she tends to do, which always tend to kind of bias towards the air element. So this is the kind of mental and social presence. So you're collaboratively reading together, and you also have this narrative distillation of an archive. And so she's like reading an entire archive and then basically poetically translating into this story that gives you a sense of some of the different other stuff that's in the archive. And so you end up listening to an audio narration. So she's reading to you, and you have to negotiate how to co-read this book with another person. And so the form of this book also deviates from a normal book, where it starts to be more of a pop-up book or something that is like a flat stage that can be explored within a context with another person. So the externalizing book becomes a little bit more of an abstract theatrical stage for the story as it unfolds, but there are also these more explicitly architectural elements to this book, this quote book object as well. So this piece is also creating this implicit invitation to connect and talk with your audience partner afterwards about the piece. And so really engaging in the conversation and dialectic as well. Again, more of this air element and social presence. So then the second center of gravity, I'd say, is the water element in terms of the incredible, amazing music by Nada al-Shazly. So there's a way in which that there's the timing that happens as you're reading the book, as collective reading, is very much dictated by the pacing, the rhythm of both the reading and narration of this book, almost kind of listening to an audio podcast, but also the music that's associated with it. It gives this real sense of emotionality and engagement and a rhythm and a pacing to that, that also brings it onto a whole other level of emotional tenor. And that was a really quite amazing part of that. So there's the time-based narration that's happening in the context of that, but there's also these lighting cues that are happening with both the tables have these LED lights underneath them. And so as you're reading the book, you're seeing different lights that are coming up on there, but also there's like projectors that are happening in the background that are also projecting things onto the wall. So there's a lot of like ambient light, but the lighting also gives a sense of a mood and a feeling overall, and the synchrony between the music and the lighting. And so overall, it gives you this strong sense of time as you're co-reading the story. And it almost feels like a narrative podcast of sorts, but mostly a matter of convenience, as it's like a recording of a live performance that would normally be transmitted to you live, so that it could be toured at this immersive festivals without the burden of having to pay for all the performers and musicians. If you listen to my conversation with Sister Sylvester about Drinking Breck, there's a lot of this kind of automation component of taking these live performances that she's been doing and then translating them into these more immersive performance formats to be able to tour more broadly and widely. And then the third center of gravity, I'd say, is the earth element in terms of the embodied and environmental presence. This is the book itself. It becomes this bit of this architectural object, and it has this whole spatial journey that you go on as you're reading through this book. And so the installation also has those tables and lighting effects. So that's a part of the kind of staging as you're going through all this, but also these projections that are happening on the wall. Most of the focus of the whole experience was happening within the context of the architectural nature of this quote-unquote book object, but there are other lots of theatrical elements like the environment that was definitely helping to cultivate the overall mood of the piece. And then the final piece was this fire element in terms of the active presence of your agency as you're kind of like negotiating how to co-experience and co-read this book together with another person. So you're exploring the story through this various interactions and interacting with this book object. And there's no narrative agency per se, although one could deviate from directly reading along with the text and you could go off on your own, but there's this implicit kind of social contract to stay on course, since you're negotiating how to experience this with another person, and that would perhaps like be detrimental to their experience. And so there's a bit of like playing nice to be able to just limit and bound your agency and not kind of go off in these different areas. There's a moment in the experience where you're asked to actually rip the book, which feels like a very much a transgression, but it also that action is thematically amplifying different aspects of the story as well. So it's a really nice pairing of the different actions into different key turning points within the story as well. And so some of the different themes is that you're just having this exploration of the quote, lost and missing queer archives through time and by the ghosts, both erotic and historical, that visit the older Cavafe in his poems. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Sister Sylvester happened on Friday, September 12th, 2025. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Sister Sylvester, and I guess I kind of make work around performance, film, and immersive media things. And at Venice this year, I was showing Constantinopoliad, which I created with Nada al-Shazly, and is a, I guess maybe like a essay film broken up into different parts that the audience kind of finds themselves at the center of.
Mm. Nice. And maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Sure. I guess my background is mostly in live performance. And I had also been working on a film. I think I kind of found myself working in this space because of a series of works I was making with a filmmaker called Dennis Torton, and a piece of work that we made that was, we first made this short film and then we made a VR piece called Shadow Time. And that was, yeah, that was more of a kind of traditional VR piece. And so was also at Venice and then kind of touring around other festivals in this space.
Okay. And yeah, I think it also there's a lot of connections to Drinking Brecht. In Drinking Brecht, there's a lot more film juxtaposing, context switching in between, but giving opportunities for the audience to read. And so maybe you could set the broader context for what I'm going to try to say the name of the piece, Constantinopoliad, as Constant.
Constantinopoliad. Yes, a lot of syllables.
So the Iliad combined with Constantinople, so Constantinopoliad. So where did this project begin?
This project was actually a commission from the Onassis Foundation, and it was a commission to create a live performance piece in response to the archive of Constantine Cavafy, this poet. They had acquired the archive and they were commissioning, I can't remember how many, 8, 12, some amount of artists to respond to the archive as a way to kind of celebrate the anniversary of Cavafy and also the opening of a new museum to hold the archive of his work. And so they commissioned me and Nada to work together and create something responding to his archive. And I think one of the reasons that they came to me with that commission was because I had been making, I kind of make a series of works which all involve handmade books, like handmade artist books. And Cavafy made his own books as a way to circulate his poetry in the world. And so I think that was the kind of point of connection and why they brought me in, because they thought I would have a way to think about the archive in response to kind of the material bookmaking that Cavafy was doing. Yeah, and so originally the piece was a live performance which involved handmade books. And then a little bit like with Drinking Brecht, I have since adapted it to try and create this kind of installation version that can exist in a very different way to the kind of full-scale live performance.
Yeah, and so in both of those pieces, what we see as this video narration or this audio narration in Constantinopoliad, so what would normally be a live performance was kind of recorded and given to the audience to listen to. And so as this was coming in, I'm just trying to get a sense of when you got the commission and what else was happening in the world and other experiences.
The commission, I think, was 2022 to, I think we premiered in 2023 with the piece. It feels a lot longer ago, which is why I'm hesitating, but I think it was
Okay.
2023, or maybe it was 2021 and we premiered in 2022. It was definitely kind of like tail end of COVID as I was making it. And then this adaptation actually came about because of Mark from CPH, who had seen, he came to Athens to see the live performance. And we'd been trying to figure out a way to bring the live performance to CPH. And it's obviously like, you know, it's a, there's kind of 7, 8 of us that tour with the live performance. It's a really kind of heavy lift. And so partly also in response to Drinking Brecht, there was this idea that we could actually create a version of it that could travel much more lightly and could fit better inside of this kind of festival context. And so, yeah, I don't think it's all that different from, I mean, it's different in scale from the live performance, but because the live performance of, like, I don't work with actors in any of my live performances, it's really around objects, these books, these narrations, films that are happening live. And so there's this really nice kind of easy transition into creating these installation versions of them.
I partly asked just to help orient in space and time this project as it was developing, because, you know, as I was going to IFA Doc Lab, I had a chance to see Ant Hampton's Borderline Visible, which I feel like is probably the closest in terms of like experientially the process of like he had two versions where you could just sit down with his book and he had like a book you could just flip through and look at, but he had like a very specific 45 minutes to an hour long version where you would go through the book and flip through the pages and move all around. But he also had a collective reading of that where it was just that audio being played while it was just a group of people all flipping through the book. And so just curious, you know, when you came across that piece and if you had already finished what you were doing with
Yeah, I
Constantinople.
mean, I've been making these reading pieces since 2018. So I have a piece called The Eagle and the Tortoise that is also a piece that you read, although in that piece you move back and forth between listening to narration and watching this live film and then reading an individual book. So I had been working on that, and then I had been working on this piece. So I heard about Amp's piece at IDFA, but I couldn't get in to see it because it was completely sold out. So I wasn't able to see it there. So I only got to see it at Open City this last, what was it, March or May, earlier this year. And I loved it. And there are obviously so many similarities between the kind of worlds of the pieces. But I've also since been discovering that there's this whole genre of, what did someone call it recently? Ambient literature, which are these kind of works around books, which I find so fascinating. And I came to it in my own work through just a complete, like, not knowing about any of this tradition of these kind of ambient literature pieces, just needing a solution to a problem, which was that I needed in the Eagle and the Tortoise audience members to be able to encounter text individually and then think about text collectively. And like, I also make books, and so it seemed a really kind of a nice solution to be able to give them these books that the pieces then moved around. But yeah, I'm now very excited to kind of explore all of these other book related pieces and think about other ways that books, and also thinking about it from the literary point of view. Like, I read a book recently by one of my favorite authors, Laszlo Krasznahorkai. And this book is this amazing, it's like a, traditionally published, I think it's published by New Directions, but it has a QR code at the beginning of each chapter. And the QR code has a piece of music that's specifically composed for that chapter and these beautiful illustrations in it. So it's this kind of expanded literature from that side, in a way that I feel like some of us working in the more like performance realms are coming at it from the other direction, but also playing with the same things.
Yeah, and Ant's piece, A Borderline Visible, you probably read through, like he reads through probably like 5 or 10 or maybe 15, maybe 20% of the book through the experience. And then you're kind of left with you to explore the rest of the book on your own. So it was like this trying to translate a vastness of a book down into like a more manageable experience, but something that was time-based and something that would also be a consistent experience. And in your piece, you basically cover 100% of what's written. In fact, sometimes you may go off script and add even more stuff that goes above and beyond what people are able to follow along with. But you decided to match people up with another person to read through this book. And part of the whole experience is to kind of figure out where you're reading and when it actually appears, because it's not necessarily like a linear experience of your have like this kind of pop-up book where it becomes a little bit of a puzzle, but also this negotiation of how do you co-read with another person. And so just curious to hear a bit around your constraints of trying to find new ways of reading in this kind of social paired experience.
Yeah, it's less about trying to find new ways of reading and more about responding to the archive. I mean, sometimes I think this isn't really a book at all that you're encountering. It's actually an archive. And every chapter of it unfolds. I mean, it's also drawing on this history of kind of artist books, this tradition of artist books that is, it's not like a, it's not like a published book you get in a shop. It's using all of these different, I make the book with this amazing artist and architect called Efrin Özyetiş. And I think it shows that architecture tradition shows inside of the book, because it is a structure almost more than it's a traditional book. I mean, there's sections of it that unfold as an accordion book. There's sections of it unfold as a kind of map. There's parts of it that, as you say, kind of mirror Cavafy's own work in the way that he would stick extra pieces of paper at the end of a page if he hadn't got enough space to finish a poem. So there's sections that unravel from the end of a book. Like, a big part of it, one whole chapter, is actually not a book at all, but a box, an archive box that contains these tiles. And the last part of it is this kind of like broad spread of a page rather than an actual bound book. So yeah, in a way, I think there's no binding in it actually. So it's more of a like an archival structure than it is. It's easier to refer to it as a book, so people have a clearer idea what you're talking about. But yeah, the idea was to try and find a way to have people experience that kind of intimacy and excitement that you get when you are given access to an archive like that. Each chapter is made of a different kind of paper. There's moments when scenes from inside the page kind of appear, and there's moments when scenes from on top of the page appear, and playing with this idea of what is written into history and what is written out of history. The idea of reading with a stranger came about in part, the book is really intricate. It takes about a week to make each book. And so part of it was just a very practical thing of how are we going to make enough books for the premiere of, all of these people. But in The Eagle and the Tortoise, I had experimented with people reading together and reading apart, and there's such a different feeling to that. And in this, there's a sense that it's not participatory. You don't have to kind of, you're not forced to interact with each other and you're not forced to do anything. But there's something I really like in this idea of trying to figure out how to negotiate this quite complicated object with a stranger and how you do that non-verbally and how you share this object together and take this journey together. And it's really lovely sometimes to see that people will stay behind at the end of the piece and just sit chatting with each other at the table, kind of comparing experiences, talking about what the book is and what the story is and what they just kind of experience together.
Yeah, it's one of the trends that I've started to see in terms of documentary filmmakers starting to take these vast archives of some body of work and then, sometimes train AI on it and then give you access to it. Or the top winner at South by Southwest this year, The Pale Little Red Dot, which was by Chloe Lee, that was also at Venice this year. Another example of taking an archive of like 40 to 50 hours worth of interviews recorded in Singapore and to basically like have this kind of mixed reality way of getting access to it. So obviously with like an archive or body of work, you're looking at the context of like poetry and other writings. And so, but I haven't typically heard people refer to books as an archive. And so because we're in this experiential aspect where you're also bringing in other elements, I'm just curious if you could like expand upon, this concept of archives and all that it may include.
Well, I mean, the Cavafis are like, well, the commission was to respond to an archive, like a very concrete archive, a collection of all of the letters and texts and poems and drafts and materials that were left in Cavafis' apartment in Alexandria. So, I mean, it's about as traditional an archive as you can get, in terms of that. And
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds like that you're producing this kind of multimedia book, that's kind of trying to, in some ways, provide a portal into this archive.
I mean, the book is, it contains the story, but it also asks you to navigate. Like, I sometimes think of these books that in these different pieces I make as their own choreography. So the book itself, each chapter, the ways this book is structured relate to the story, the kinds of paper that the book is made from relate to the story. As I said, like one chapter is not a, in some ways it's not a book. It has no traditional binding. It has no traditional kind of book structure. One section of it is a box. One section of it is a like map. One section of it is so I do think of it more as kind of like the kinds of material you would encounter in an archive. Like each chapter is a very different set of materials that you're navigating.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear a bit more around your collaborative process with Nada because you were co-commissioned to work on this piece together and you're given access to this vast archive. And so, where did you two begin in terms of getting familiar with this archive and then trying to figure out how your collaboration would play out?
It was really lovely and fortuitous and amazing. I mean, we didn't know each other before, and it became a really beautiful working relationship. I think the beginning, like when we first started talking, I was telling her I'd been thinking about this astronomer who also features in the text, Antoniadi, and this idea he created this scale of seeing to measure levels of obfuscation in the atmosphere between the person looking through the telescope and the thing that they were looking at. So the scale of seeing is kind of like how much obfuscation there is between you and the thing you're looking at. And Cavafis' poems are very much, they're about looking at the past, but they're really about the impossibility of looking at the past. They're about all the things that stand in the way of you and this object in the past. And so I was talking with her about that, and she said, this is an amazing coincidence. I've been researching the difficulty of listening through time. So where I was looking at the difficulty of kind of seeing through time, she was looking at the difficulty of listening through time. And the piece begins with this story of the conference in Cairo to create a set of notation for Arab music. And so she had been looking at this conference and the impossibility of trying to think about or hear music from before that time, not only because it wasn't recorded, but because these moments where things get these kind of epochal shifts where music becomes notated change the structure of our brains. They change the way we can think about that form. And so she had been in her first album trying to imagine what those sounds might have been from before that time. Even in the process of acknowledging it was impossible to ever get back to ways of making music from before that kind of epochal shift. And so that became a really nice place for us to meet and think through the piece, and those stories of hers I incorporated into the writing of the piece. And then it became a process of us kind of like talking every week as I was writing. And then, you know, we live in different cities, and then we got together for a few workshops where we would experiment with the sounds and the text together. And then, as I said, Efrin Özyetiş was another really key collaborator on it, in thinking about how we bring these three elements together: the words, the sound, and the physical object.
And how would you describe Covafe? How would you tell his story of who he was?
Kavafi?
Covafe, yeah, sorry.
Kavafi, yeah. I mean, the Greeks call him Kavafis, but he anglicized his name, so he actually wrote it as Kavafi. I mean, I think he's a fascinating character. You know, when I first got the commission, I thought, I'm not Greek, I'm not from Alexandria. Like, I don't know Greece. I'd never been to Greece at that point. I have no relationship to this country. It's a strange archive to try to respond to, the archive of this kind of gay man from the 1800s who lives in a city I've never been to and comes from a country I've never been to. But the point of connection that I could find as I was researching his work was that I was living in Istanbul at the time, and he's also considered an Istanbul poet, especially by kind of queer writers and artists in Istanbul, because he spent 2 years there when he was a teenager. And I thought maybe that was a point that I could enter into his work, like who he was as a foreigner in these 2 years in Istanbul. So when I first went to the archive, I asked them if they had any material on his Constantinople time. And they said basically they had nothing, but they had this one little, they had very, very little, but they had this one journal that he'd kept on his journey from Alexandria to Constantinople when his family were fleeing because the British were bombing the city. And this journal is called the Constantinopoliad. And that was the first point where, I mean, looking at this journal, it's this beautiful little, firstly, it's this handmade, hand-bound journal that he keeps. And he writes the first 5 pages of it, and then it's completely blank. And the archivists were very apologetic for that. But actually, this idea of the teenage Kavafi leaving his city, thinking he's going to write the next epic poem, writing 5 pages and then abandoning it completely, was really kind of charming and endearing. And the blank pages, of course, then give you so much creative license to think about completely other things. And for me, that was the idea of kind of queer archives more broadly, archives that are lost, what doesn't get written into history, the impossibility of ever retracing what happened in that time for him, but the kind of like ways I could imaginatively fill the gaps of that time. And so this one object became a real kind of beautiful entry point for me into how to create this project and how to respond to the archive.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear this synthesis process of like ingesting the poetry, the letters, I'm sure there might be photos or paintings or other images from that time period, and trying to find the narrative through line, which I think you've been talking about a little bit, but just curious to hear a little bit more around that process of distilling down. And what comes to mind is that like we express ourselves in different ways through our public self, through our family, our friends, through our letters. And so through letters, you get to see these kind of fractal insights into his context under which he's expressing his identity. But then you have his public poetry and all of his other work. And so just curious to hear a bit more around that process of trying to ingest this archive and then trying to distill down like his essential character through the stories that you're telling about him.
Yeah, I think it also becomes an excuse to write about what you want to write about and what you're thinking as well. You know, I'm not a journalist, so I'm not trying to create, I'm not an academic, I'm not trying to create some kind of faithful interpretation of the archive, but it allowed me to think through, you know, like I said, this idea of this peer of his who was in Constantinople at the time, and this idea of seeing through time and history. And, you know, there's a, for me, the kind of one of the moments of the piece that gets to the heart of what I was thinking about is this moment where you stop reading and you're holding the tile, and the story is about this scrap of papyrus that was found in a rubbish dump, which talked about the relationship between the female choir leader and the singers in the choir. So it's about this female queer relationship, and the mistranslation that happens when that scrap is found, and the fact that the translator, who I think is, you know, some like Victorian British guy, translates, instead of translating it as a lover, the relationship, he translates it as a god, And these mistranslations, the way that they can change history, the way that they can wipe out the possibilities for particular identity, the way that they can, legitimize or unlegitimize ways of being in the world. And so that, for me, that moment of like that purposeful obscuring of a past is what Kavafi allowed me to think about.
Yeah, come back to the layers of seeing or the levels of seeing that you talked around in terms of like how clearly can we see. And yeah, as time goes on, then you're gonna have more context and you get new lenses as you look back into the history. So it's
And also,
a
but also, who's obscuring that past? Like, who's creating those layers of obfuscation? Who's taking that out of reach? And what can we do to bring those archives, those moments of history back into the current narrative? Because, that's how people justify the ways that the world is now. And so, like, finding those blank pages in the archive, finding those, discarded moments from history becomes a kind of active reclamation.
I'm curious to hear your own experience of reading in the context of an immersive experience and why you put so much of your work onto the mechanic of reading and the power of reading.
I don't, none of these pieces were created for this context of the kind of immersive world. They were created as live performances, which it's funny, I guess we don't really talk about immersive as much because it's maybe all immersive, or I don't know. But I still think that immersive, I don't really know what that word means. Like, I think we've had this conversation before. I'm a Brechtian and I hate immersion. I hate the idea of immersion. I think critical distance is what we should all be looking for. So, but I do think that reading is still, for me, a much more powerful technology than, say, VR. In terms of creating worlds, I think that the magic of reading these letters on a page, like transporting you into other worlds, is such a fascinating technology. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, I think that I'm interested in playing with that with these other elements like sound and film media, different media. And I think I'm also very interested in the kind of like move between what it means to read individually and what it means collectively. In the history of reading, it's only very recently that we started to read silently. Reading was a public, no one read a comic when it, but like, the monks would read aloud. It's only, I think, in the Victorian era that we started to reading became a silent activity. And so thinking about what it means to read communally and what it means to read individually, it's also a thing you can do with other people in a way that doesn't feel like a forced participation. And I really love that. And you can share these worlds with people, but you are also holding them in a very individual way. And you don't know what other people are interpreting. You're not seeing the same image. You're seeing the same words, but you're turning that into something very different. I like that idea a lot as well. But yeah, they're not created for, I don't think these are necessarily a comment. Like, a lot of people at Venice were like, wow, you're like saying, you're this is such a rebellion against the VR, and it's not because I didn't create it for this context. I love that they're showing it in Venice, and I think it's very different than VR, obviously, but it's not created as a response to this world of work. It's its own very separate thing that I think maybe has interesting conversations with this world of work.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on immersion and experiential design specifically to your project that, I think even if you are kind of rejecting kind of immersion, I think you're still an experiential designer. You're designing these experiences and you're including elements that I would classify as different immersive qualities, but we can get into that. But before we do, I wanted to also just comment on just the experience of reading while also being read to. I wanted to just contrast that to my experience of Ant Hampton's piece with Borderline Visible, because in that piece, there's a lot of extra things to look at and to read at your own speed. Because, as I'm listening to you read and my reading speed is faster. And so, in your experience, there's all of the associated design of the book that I have time to look at and to also kind of take in this broader context of like almost like a theatrical scene that you're staging with each page of the book. You're able to cut to a new scene and slowly unfold that scene in a process that involves unfolding the book and seeing how that spatial dimension of the experience can augment that. But I was just really struck with how you're using that other aspect of the spatial design of the book to maybe fill in the gap between our need to have, like, if you were just reading it to us without any extra thing, then it would just be a podcast at that point. But to make it more of an interactive and immersive experience, you're having the book. And my experience of Hampton was that you could kind of like skip ahead or read around or look at another photo as you were still kind of tracing what was happening. Or if, you know, for some people, they may want to read word for word everything that's being said, which I also did that as well. So just curious to hear some of your thoughts on the pacing between having it read to versus your own kind of reading speed and ability to take in all this other information that you're providing.
Yeah, I mean the fact that the tech we say at the start, Nada and I in the introduction, you know, we will be your metronome, and we're going to create this kind of like text that is read, and you can feel like that is a thread that's guiding you through. I really wanted to play with the idea of being in the archive, where the archivist is leaning over your shoulder and interpret and trying to read along with you and trying to decipher what's written. And also, as you said, like the reading pace is pretty slow, so that you are able to. You know, the drawings often don't match with what is being said. Efren and I had this very different process of creating the illustrations of the text. And so the reading pace allows you to kind of work with the person you're reading with, but also to spend time with these different elements. Like you said, the structure of the book, the ways that it unfolds, the different layers of kind of vellum and things that are in the book, the illustrations in the book, the way that the light interacts with those illustrations. And so it was an attempt to capture this feeling of being in the archive and the archivist being there and being this presence that you could rely on as you explored around those materials.
Yeah, I wanted to poke at the skepticism around immersion and maybe revisit it after I kind of see how I look at your piece, but just trying to get at like why the resistance and why, you know, maybe just elaborate on that critical distance and what you're afraid of in terms of the being classified of immersion, or if you're just resistant, like just trying to get
I'm
a
just
better
resistant
sense.
because I think it's a word that gets used too much without any real meaning. I think it's just too fuzzy. I think that, you know, and again, like I said, I mean, I love Brecht. I like the idea of work that is political and asking you to think. I don't work with characters. I don't work with stories in the traditional sense. I don't work with like losing yourself in a narrative that you then like I am a epic theater person, you know. I want that distance and that critical engagement and the moments where you act. But also, I mean, there's that. There's my personal kind of what I want to do with the art that I make. But there's also just the fact that this term gets used for everything. I mean, where does immersion stop? Reading is immersive. You read a book, you conjure whole. Like I forget where I am when I read a book. I miss my subway stop because I'm so in the book. That's immersion. Everything's immersion. So I don't know what. I think I reject the term because I think it's too fuzzy and I don't know what the parameters of it are.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, on the Voices of VR podcast, we're on a VR podcast and we're talking around your project that's a book. And so this is something that I've had to sort of justify in my own mind of like, how do I cover the full spectrum of what is being called these immersive projects without it being technically virtual reality? And so for me, I break it up into these different qualities of presence, which I think in your piece, it's like dominant in terms of the air element, in terms of the mental and social presence. You're reading, you're using the abstractions of language to communicate. And, you know, with every experience, there can be narration or dialogue or things where it uses the air element. But reading specifically is like the air element to the extreme because you're really also feeding into your imagination. But because you're also including all these other elements where it's interactive, it's participatory. So there's the fire element of being able to actually to turn the pages and to actually unfold this kind of spatial architecture of this book that you've created. And you're doing it with another person. So there's another air element, social dimension, where you have to kind of negotiate with your body in a nonverbal way how to navigate this journey together with another person through kind of nonverbal cues that you're having with each other. And so you have a lot of your embodiment that is physically holding the book, but also turning the pages, the sensory haptic experience of that. And the sensory experience of the lights, which I think also kind of feeds into me a little bit more of the water element, the emotions. To the music is like driving a lot of emotions throughout the course of this piece that's really setting the tenor. The story that you're telling is also setting that emotional tenor, but also the lighting that you're using is really modulating emotion in a way that's really subtle and really provocative in some ways because you're having text that can only be seen with this translucent nature of some of the pages that are kind of occluded that you would only be able to see it if there's like illuminated from underneath. And so, and yeah, the earth element being more of the body embodiment, this spatial design. And so your canvas in this way is this object that we're holding, that we're exploring in this kind of like architecture of the book that we're able to kind of play with and unfold. And so for me, you have all of these elements that go beyond just the experience of reading a book. It's like this time-based medium where you're adding like these mental and social presence of the air element, the fire element of the agency, the embodiment of the earth element, and this kind of environmental spatial design of both the set that you have and all of the projectors that are going in the background, projecting images on the walls, but also this table that we're at that has this whole spatial experience with the lighting. And then, yeah, the motion of the piece that I think is kind of the through line of the story that you're telling, but also kind of the mood of the music and the lighting. So that's at least how I start to break down the elements of immersion of your piece. So I'd love to hear any response or any reactions.
I love that way of breaking it down. I still don't know that it's, I mean, immersion, I still don't know what the parameters of immersion are, you know? It's less like, I mean, I love the fact that this piece can be included in these other works, and but I think I just have to like kind of push back against the term a little because I don't know what's not immersive in the ways that we use it. Like, I don't know if there would be an ex was there were there any experiences in Venice that were not immersive?
Well, so I think, I mean, the challenge with all of life is immersive. So, I think for me, part of what I see is happening with XR and kind of this immersive media, immersive storytelling, is that there's existing design disciplines that are coming like firmly from like the theatrical tradition or from dance tradition or architecture from the earth element or, from the water element of the cinematic tradition or music tradition or from the fire element, the game design tradition, or from the air element, more literature or the process of creating and cultivating social dynamics that are emergent. And so I think the uniqueness around what's happening in XR is that there's a blending and blurring of all those things together where it's kind of like blending together these different design disciplines. And so for me, that's at least how I start to make sense of it as I see all the work and talk to the creators and try to find a way of like, what's the through line? And I start with my own phenomenology, my own experience of the piece. And then from there, like ask creators like yourself, well, what were you thinking around this decision, this trade-off between this or that? Of course, all of life is immersive, but I feel like XR is able to kind of bring in all these different elements of presence in a way that feels like a unique moment that merits like a new name to
Yeah,
kind of describe it.
I'd agree with that. I just, for me, again, I think because I'm coming from a kind of performance tradition, this idea of immersion in the Aristotelian tradition versus the idea of like a kind of epic theater or critical distance in the Brechtian tradition. I think maybe it just like pushes my buttons because of that, because I very much don't want to be making work in that like Aristotelian tradition of and I think that like certainly in the early VR days, one of the things I was reacting against was this idea of empathy and it being an empathy machine and it creating a kind of, you know, cathartic experience. And I disliked that so much that maybe that is also where I worry that immersive is following on from that conversation.
We talked at IFA Doc Lab around drinking Brecht, and we really dug into a little bit more of this difference between Aristotelian and the Brechtian modes of storytelling. And I just want to clarify because, just to help maybe illuminate some of your resistance, because it feels like that this idea that you would go into a place and cathart your emotions and then leave in the more of Aristotelian catharsis, that it's a little bit more of a passive way of processing things rather than actually being actively engaged in the deeper context of the world around you. Like you enter in a magic circle and you have this kind of cathartic process, but yet what happens after you leave that? And is that part of the resistance? Is that you don't want
I
to?
think it is. And I think that's related to kind of the like a lot of the early VR, which was focused very much on kind of like social good and framing itself as this device for social good through the medium of empathy. And I think I just find that a really dangerous and wrong way of thinking about the medium. I think it can do so many things. I think it's a really exciting medium, but I don't think that putting someone closer to the experience of another person leads to social change. I think it's in fact the opposite. And I think, you know, we have this huge tradition that shows us that, you know, Aristotelian drama is used to control the citizens. You know, you emote inside of the safe space of the theater, you purge yourself of those dangerous emotions through identification with characters, and then you can leave and go back to being a docile citizen. Whereas the, you know, the epic theater is this other tradition where the work is trying to maintain your, to not allow you to identify in that way, to not allow you to lose yourself in the immersion inside of the piece, but to maintain a critical distance from it so that you're able to actually use the piece as a tool to go back out into the world and to think about the relationship between what you've seen and what is in the world.
Yeah, I feel like that, you know, the way that I think about these concepts, or at least this process relational philosophy, where you're in right relationship to the world around you, where, you know, there can be the risk of not being in a relationship where you sort of step in the shoes and someone in the VR experience, and then you get this impression that you can somehow have a deeper understanding of someone's life, but without building that deeper relationality to that person or that situation, then is that simulation really bringing you that much closer? And so it sounds like that also this idea of catharsis and coming out and not really doing anything about it, it's another way of not really being in relationship to the world around you in a way that is actively engaged with how everything's unfolding, you know, becoming more of an active participant.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Susan Sontag thing, right? You know, the identification with those photographs making you feel like you have done something when you haven't at all. And so that is, I guess those are the things I think of when I hear the word immersion. But that's just because of the tradition that I'm coming from.
Well, just to go back to your own design process, because there are lots of things that you're doing above and beyond, let's say, the tradition of literature, where you're bringing in all these theatrical, let's say, maybe they're all coming from theater for you, but just curious how you start to think around the way that you're using lighting and modulating lighting throughout the course of this piece.
Yeah, I think that a big part of it in the design of this was this idea that we needed a light box to think about the archive, but also because of this strong strand in the piece, which is about the things that are lost to history, the things that don't get inscribed in the official narrative. And so there's this kind of beautiful thing that, you know, we were talking about this a lot, and Efrin found this way. I remember her holding up a piece of paper to the window in Istanbul and putting two layers together, and like, you know, us just being able to see what was on the bottom layer and thinking, okay, that's a really central device of this piece that we can play with. Like, what are the things, what are the counter narratives that are hidden inside the page, and how can we use this structure to play with what you see from above and what you see from below, and where light is coming from and how that's illuminating history differently, and the narrative, how the narrative is shifting between those things. So I really love the section in when it becomes an accordion book in the chapter about straightening things out, where it's pulsing between the different lights. So you're seeing from below and then from above and then from below and from above, and this kind of like counter narrative is visually emerging in the piece. But I also think, you know, and maybe this is counter my aversion to immersion, but I think that the lights and the sounds together do exactly what you say, which is create this kind of really beautiful kind of bubble around you, or like trance world somehow that you're in as you read it. And it became really important to me, even designing the space, to try and keep it as quiet and dark as possible in there, in a way that's, I think, like, you know, theatrical in a way, because there is something quite delicate about the piece that if you're too distracted, you can never quite find your rhythm inside of it. But I think that the lights and the sound create that new rhythm for you, or like allow you to enter into a different rhythm from the outside world, which is the rhythm of the piece.
Yeah, and the way that you're using color with that as well, because these like LED lights are changing color sometimes very subtly and slowly, but just the way the kind of painting with the colors changes the mood of
Well,
the moment.
partly we couldn't afford to print in color. So lights become a way that we can actually create a color palette inside of the piece. Or I should say, there's really limited parts of the book that are printed in color. Most of it is either just blue text on different kinds of paper or black text on different kinds of paper.
Well, there was one very provocative moment that may or may not be a spoiler in terms of if people go through this experience, but you ask the audience to basically rip a page. And I didn't do it at first because I was like, what? What? And then I was like, surely she doesn't mean to actually literally rip this page, because I was like thinking in my back of my mind, just the process of like having to set up a new book. I was like, surely they are not having to like reset these all up in that way. And then, but then the person I was with was like, yeah, rip the page, rip it open. And so then it was like, it felt like such a moment of taboo because that's like the thing you're not supposed to do with books is to actually rip pages. And so you're asking us to do something that is a taboo act, but then also it starts to pull into this whole area of Cavafe's like kind of more hidden taboo aspects of sexuality that I felt really paired nicely, this kind of embodied action, that request to tear the page, but also thematically how it's covering this other aspect of Cavafe's life that even today is still somewhat taboo to think about or talk about. So anyway, I don't know if you have any comments on this.
Yeah, and it also follows a whole section on book burning and the destruction of queer archives and the relationship between, bodies and books and the destruction of books and the destruction of bodies and the destructions of histories and the destruction of physical people. And so I think that I'm really happy to hear that it feels like a taboo, because of course it's a tiny, in this world where you're doing all sorts of things in headsets and jumping around and interacting in all these wild ways, like it's a very quiet action, actually. You're just, ripping a tiny little piece of paper. You're not actually ripping, you're just ripping a small piece of paper so you can open the next section. But I love that it feels taboo. And actually, in the live performance, I would often have to ask people several times before they would actually do it. So I love that this actually tiny gesture carries that weight inside of the piece. But of course, also, there's in that Constantinopoliad of Cavafis, there are pages that are torn out. So it relates to that as well. And as you say, the kind of like breaking something open and his sexuality and how he had to keep it hidden from someone, which is why he made his own book so that he could control the reception of his poems. But it does also follow this chapter on the destruction of books and culture and how that also relates to the destruction of bodies.
Yeah, for listeners, it feels like a really epic kind of pop-up book adventure that you take people on because, as you go through each of these pages, you're kind of discovering these little things that you can move out. And that scene is particularly fun just because it, you're in this new taboo world that you get to explore of sexuality, which is a
It's
lot of
a yeah, it's
fun.
a pop-up orgy. And yeah, it's a really beautiful. I mean, Efren again, who did the illustrations, I love that final scene. She made it incredibly beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of culminates the piece as well, I think,
Yeah. And it's a kind of like it's a, that final page. We also had long discussions about, how to work on this archive of this queer man as a team who are all femme on different, like areas of the spectrum of queerness and femness, and how I love that final scene because Efren really creates a kind of utopic world in it that is not the gay man utopic world of queerness, but is a very different world of queerness. And so again, this is where like the illustrations and the text are not necessarily like one-to-one correlations, but I think Efren's drawings bring us into this really beautiful kind of possible utopia that could, Cavafy talks about himself hoping that through his being alive, some point in the future, someone like him will appear and will be free to be themselves. And I think Efren's interpretation of that is a really beautifully expansive interpretation of that. And that comes through in the drawings.
Well, Nada was not able to join us today for this conversation, but curious to hear any other comments on the music that she was able to provide
I
for the
mean,
piece.
the music is just so beautiful. It's such an incredible score. She's brilliant. And it's also such a joy performing it live with her. And in the live version, it's fairly set, but we find these moments of improvisation and we find these moments of dialogue. And really the only thing that I think that I miss in the live performance is that very, very final section where in the live performance, Nada gets up, leaves the table that we're sitting at, which is in the center of the space. We're very unobtrusive in the space. Everyone's sitting at these tables and we're at the center and I'm reading and Nada's playing music and speaking sometimes. And there's that one moment where she puts down the microphone and she gets up and she walks around the room completely unmic'd, singing. And all the lights on the table, just the bottoms of the table, are blue, illuminating the space. And it's like she's conjuring the ghosts of these cabarets back. And all of the ghosts of the story and the Cavafy's poems are being conjured back into the space. And it makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. It's so beautiful. And obviously we recorded that and we tried as best we could to spatialize it in the headphones, but the live, that's the thing that I really miss. from the only thing that I think we can't get with such precision in the recorded version. But yeah, her music is incredible. The score of it, you know, I sometimes think that I like my writing is quite, like you said, it's really air element. It's very kind of heady and intellectual, and there's moments of emotion in it, but the emotions are quite restrained. And so I think that's where Nada's music does a very different thing, and it works very well in kind of like tension with my words and also Efren's drawings. I think there's a really beautiful kind of triad between the three elements of the piece. And the way that they kind of like do very different things, but exist in this tension with each other.
Dare I say immersive?
No.
How do you self-identify with this blend and blur of everything? How would you describe it yourself?
A collective reading experience
Collective
is
reading. Okay.
how I like to describe it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're because you have other
An essay film.
experiences.
Like, I think it's still an essay film, and I don't
Essay
think of an
film.
essay film as immersive, you know?
Well, but you're blending the two of an essay film and a collective reading. That's the thing that makes it immersive, in my mind. It's the blending and the
Maybe,
blurring of it. It's the fusion of these forms with theater and other
yeah.
literature. You know, it's the combination of everything that makes it like this ambiguous liminal space that we don't have good
How
language
about a
for.
multimedia video essay?
Okay, multimedia video essay. Okay.
I mean, that sounds
Well,
really clunky and boring. Yours sounds much better, but
I usually ask people what they think the ultimate potential of immersive storytelling in XR is, but what would you
sure.
think is the ultimate potential of this kind of multimedia collective reading experience type of thing that you do with film essay thrown in there?
What do you mean by ultimate potential?
Well, you know, I think it's like the what does art do? What's the highest exalted thing that we could expect, or that you know, another way to phrase it is what type of experiences do you want to have in this type of medium? It starts to get to like things of that hasn't happened yet, this potential of things that have not yet been realized and what it could do for your own individual experience, but also, you know, you like to think big and collectively. So where could this go in the future in terms of creating the world that we want to live in? It's a bit of a exercise
Well,
of
that's a very
speculative
big
work.
question. That's a
It's
very big
a
question to end on. Have
Well, that's how I always end. It's a speculative world building. You know, I want to
I
design
answered
the
this question
future
before?
every time. Yeah.
Oh, damn, what have I said in the past?
I'd have to go back and look.
Oh, no. What is the potential of this? I don't know. I'm feeling very depressed at the moment, so I don't know if it's a good time to, but I'm pretty sure I was feeling equally. I don't know. I mean, I feel like maybe we should all. Well, I'm not going to speak for everyone. I feel like maybe quitting and retraining as an EMT is good use of time. I think that I don't know. I don't know. I hope that this kind of work can shift narratives, provoke new ways to think about history. And with this piece in particular, I'm, you know, thinking about the stories that are left out of history and what, like, how they can become tools in creating a different kind of world. Like, if we can thread a new narrative, we can point to a new place to go. If we can build new narratives from the past, then it can set us on a new trajectory. And I think that that is what this piece is about for me.
It's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that's part of the most exalted potential is these deeper philosophical paradigm shifts that this type of art or work could bring about. Because it feels like to me, that's like the thing that's needed the most is for us to, you know, change our paradigm in terms of how we relate to each other in the world. And so, yeah, it feels like that each piece of art that we create hopefully is moving towards that. So, is there anything else that's left unsaid? Any final thoughts you'd like to share with the broader immersive community or whatever you want to call this community of storytellers and artists?
I don't think that just how amazing it was to see all the other works this year. I mean, there were a few that I really wanted to see that I didn't get to see, but it was, you know, I'm like the grumpy uncle who doesn't like a headset who somehow makes work in these spaces. But there were pieces that I saw that really made me imagine, and there's pieces I've seen in the past, but there's such beautiful work being made, and it's really pushing my own understandings of what VR can be and what it can do. And I think this was a really exciting space, particularly for VR, that kind of pushed me out of my grumpy uncle stance, and made me very excited about what people are doing with the form.
Any personal highlights that you saw?
I'm not, there's so many. There's so
Okay.
many. I also feel like I didn't see some key, I wasn't able to get in and see some key pieces that I really wanted to see. So I'm going to hope to catch them as they continue to tour.
Yeah, there were some hot tickets there that were Blur, The Clouds Are 2,000 Meters Up, and Dark Rooms were all very hot tickets that
Yeah.
were hard to
Just
get
very hard
into.
to get to. Yeah. Even if you
So,
stayed for the whole festival.
yeah, there were only so many slots a day and
Yeah.
probably the most in-demand tickets that were there. So,
Yeah.
awesome. Well, Sister Sylvester, thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to break down your latest work, Constantinopoliad, and really enjoyed the piece, and also really enjoy, as always, the discussions that we have, because I think you're a deep thinker and experiential designer. And I don't know, maybe you'll find a better word than immersive to self-identify that encompasses everything that we're talking about here. For me, that I'm happy with it, but I understand the resistance to go with that, to really challenge and to see if there's, more precise language. I try to achieve that in my podcast, but for the larger community, that doesn't always hold true. So the way that people call immersive would kind of strain some people's definitions of what that might mean. So especially as we move forward. But yeah, I just always appreciate this kind of fusion of things that you're doing with film essay, with the collective reading experience, the social dynamics, the kind of embodiment that you have with the lighting and the theatrical nature and the stories that you're telling, and also the music that's being woven throughout this piece as well. So all together, it creates a really powerful experience. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage. And hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening. Thank you.